Hello and welcome to the Poorly Informed Podcast for this first episode of Season 2. It's great to be back with you guys. I'm your host this week, Theo, and with me are Max and Peter. Unfortunately, Will is away at the moment, so we weren't able to get him in this week, but he'll be back. So, before we get into the main discussion with John Redwood, we thought it would be useful to break down some of the key terms and concepts we're going to be talking about. Maybe you're familiar with what austerity is, and if so, and you just want to get on with the proper interview, you can find the in the description where you need to skip to start from there. However, if you just want a little bit of background build up to help you understand what we're going to be talking about, then we're going to be breaking that down now. The acoustics might be slightly different. We're recording this separately and then meeting Mr. Redwood later. So, guys, what are some of the key concepts? Obviously, austerity is something we really need to make sure we hammer down. Peter, could you run over what austerity is?
The general definition of austerity is sort of severe budget cuts in an attempt by a government to save money, essentially, and the conditions created by them.
Yeah, so in 2010, George Osborne and the David Cameron government announced an austerity of government spending, so decreasing government spending on several counts, but also raising taxes as well to try and eliminate the deficit in government spending. Max, what's a deficit?
So the government deficit is the difference between the amount of money the government makes in terms of taxation and other sort of money making things for the government compared to what they spend. So if they spend 100 billion, let's say, it's obviously a lot more than that. So if they spend 100 billion but they only make 90 billion in taxes, they have a deficit of 10 billion. And so with your deficit, when as that progresses each year, that then causes your debt to increase because you have to borrow that money to support the deficit.
So you have to borrow debt to make to cover the gap between revenue and spending. Okay, so in 2010, after having to bail out the banks in the global financial crisis, we had a significant deficit at about 10% of GDP or government spending. So we have a problem, and George Osborne implemented this policy of austerity. So we've mentioned the global financial crisis, and that was amidst what we call now called the Great Recession. Peter, can you break this down for us?
Yeah, recession is where a country has two quarters, so half a year of negative growth in the economy, and so GDP is shrinking in real terms over time.
And what happened in this Great Recession that we're going to refer to?
This Great Recession, everything stopped working. The banks has essentially all failed because they had loads of money invested in mortgages, which then no one paid back. And everyone lost confidence, everyone tried to pull out their money. There was mass panic, and almost every major economy in the world shrunk. I think almost every economy in the world did shrink, I believe.
So
it was bad for all economies in the world, and everywhere had to take measures to try and fix the problems caused by it.
Okay, and in this country, we had a period of austerity both after the recession, when people's incomes fell, and also austerity imposed by the government as a policy to try and reduce the deficit. We think that's everything we've covered. We hope you enjoy listening to our interview with Mr. Redwood.
Yes, so because we'll be in a different room, the acoustics might sound a little bit off because it's a bit bigger and there's less carpet. So sort of bear in mind that. We hope that the quality of the content will make up for the lack in quality of audio. This is also our first sort of interview with sort of someone else and bring someone else into the podcast. So again, we might be a little rough around the edges, but hopefully you'll enjoy it.
Yeah. Thank you very much for listening. Enjoy. So welcome to the Poorly Informed Podcast. I'm this week's host, Theo. We today are going to be talking about the end of austerity with our very special guest, Mr. Redwood. Mr. Redwood, you suggested the topic, end of austerity, to talk about. What was the thinking behind this?
I have campaigned successfully twice for election to Parliament in Wokingham on the slogan, prosperity, not austerity. I wanted to draw attention to changes to economic policy that I wish to see. I think before we can develop the conversation, though, we need to decide what austerity is. I think there are two big elements to austerity. Some people just see austerity as meaning a government that pursues a set of cuts over public services and public spending. That has been very acute and very bad in places like Greece and Italy, where the requirements of the Eurozone to have very tight controls over both budget deficits and over the amount of borrowing have led to draconian cuts. They've been actually cutting the cash pay of state employees, and they have been reducing the numbers in state employment. In the United Kingdom, because there was a very big budget deficit and a financing problem in 2010, inherited by the coalition from Labour after the crash, there was a decision to have very, very slow growth in public spending. It wasn't nearly as severe as the cash cuts that we saw on the continent. But it did mean that in some areas, in some programmes, there were difficult decisions and problems. I think in one or two cases, the cuts went too far. But overall, UK public spending grew in cash terms and just about grew in real terms throughout the 2010 to 2015 period. But the second, I think, more important definition of austerity is what happens to everybody else, because most people in the economy don't work for the state, they work in the private sector. And what we've seen since the banking crisis of 2007 to 9 has been big falls in real incomes in the first two or three years of the crisis, and then very slow progress in trying to recover the real incomes that were lost in the big deflationary collapse at the end of the last decade. And that, I think, is why politics have been so excitable and so difficult since the crisis hit, because people in a democracy are naturally impatient. They say, well, we always used to have 2 or 3% growth in our real incomes every year. If you're now telling us there's going to be no growth in our real incomes, or it's only going to be 1 or 2%, when we had a big hit in 2007 to 2009, we don't find that very satisfactory. So is austerity over? Well, that's what I want. And I think we're seeing two big advances in the United Kingdom. The first is that the new government, Boris Johnson, is very clearly signalling that there is a bit more public money to spend and that there will be a bit more real growth in public spending than we've had before. That I welcome. I've been campaigning for more money for working in schools. It looks as if we're going to get it, because they're now talking about taking the per capita sums for school students up to a minimum, which is considerably above what quite a lot of schools in Wokingham get. There is more money going into the health service. There has to be continuous real growth in health service budgets, and that has been assured both by the May proposals and then by the Johnson top-up. But I also think we're making progress now on the austerity problems on real incomes, and we're seeing now reasonable real income growth in the United Kingdom. And I'm hoping that in our next budget we will get some tax cuts, because I think we could accelerate the real income growth if we reduce personal taxation a bit more.
Okay, so you're saying that both de jure austerity is over and de facto austerity is beginning to reduce in terms of that public spending is increasing, most notably for the NHS, most notably for schools, and that tax cuts are now beginning to be a real possibility. Peter and Max, would you agree with Mr. Redwood that austerity is de facto over?
Yeah, not so much, not a lot to disagree with the end bit there, it says over, but you said sort of in the middle there about how public spending has increased, you know, over, you know, since 2008, it has technically increased in real terms, but I feel like when people say that, they forget the fact that we've had a 4 million population increase. So while the government spending has increased something like 47 billion or something, that only accounts for about £10,670 a person, or only that much for the new people, with no increase for everyone else. Which, if you think about when we have a increasing aging population, there are certain burdens which are increasing, that I think the government ends up spending or should spend more than that per person, which does result in, although real terms it has increased for the individual and per capita, it may have decreased.
That's a very good point. I think you do need to look at per capita figures as well as at gross figures. I think I'd make two additional points. The first is there were some programmes that did experience difficult declines in public spending. because there are other programmes that were increasing all the time, so that we saw continuous substantial increases in European Union contributions, which we couldn't do anything about. We, as a matter of policy, wanted to increase overseas aid in line with GDP, so that obviously went up. There was quite a big increase in the benefits bill generally, particularly for the elderly, because we wanted to honour the pledges that were being made. Now, on the migrant point, not all migrants are a net cost on public spending. Some migrants, those who come in for top-end jobs, contribute more than they take out. So I would just add that amendment to what you're saying. You need to look at the balance of migration. And I think that's why migration has been such a sensitive issue. And I think where people want fewer migrants, and there are quite a lot of voters who do want fewer migrants, they are thinking of trying to limit the numbers coming in to take low-end jobs, because they will probably need subsidised housing, they may need school places for their children, they may need healthcare attention, and they won't be making very much tax contribution. And so then, you're absolutely right, others need to pay rather more tax to deal with the problem. Whereas I think most people would agree with the new government, which is that we're very happy to invite in people of talent, people with money, people with business interests, people who've got good jobs to go to, because they can add to the variety and success of our country, and they don't impose the same public spending burden.
Okay, so we're operating on the assumption, therefore, that austerity, you've mentioned you campaigned for austerity, especially in this borough, to lessen. So we feel austerity as a policy should be declared dead. It has achieved what it aimed to do.
Well, I think part of austerity was thoroughly undesirable. And when did you have most austerity? You had most austerity as someone earning an income between 2007 and 2010, when we had this very intense banking crash, happens to coincide with a period of Labour government. And that did knock living standards very badly. And they began the process then of decelerating the rate of growth in public spending and starting to actually cut some big items. I mean, Labour, for example, put through a lot of cuts to public capital spending before they left office in 2010. And the coalition government wasn't able to reinstate those as quickly as one might have liked. So, for example, road improvements, much needed in this borough, were hit badly by the general attack on road capital investment at the end of the previous decade. So I think that austerity is over, because we've now got a bit of real income growth, but people want to see their real incomes rather higher relative to where they were in 2007, and we're beginning to reinstate those capital spending cuts as well.
But when George Osborne first implemented, he came out with the budget, said we are going to be entering austerity. He had two goals in mind. He wanted to achieve essentially no budget deficit, and he wanted national debt as a percentage of GDP to fall. And I would say we still have a budget deficit, we're still running a budget deficit, and debt as a percentage of GDP fell by 0.4% last year, which isn't a lot. It's essentially plateaued. Mm. So I wouldn't say they've achieved their aims they set out for austerity to achieve.
No, George Osborne did not achieve his aim. And then the aim, I think, is now being amended or watered down. I think it was a wrong aim, and I was an opponent of it at the time. I completely accept that in 2010, when the coalition came into office, it needed to get better control of the public finances, because we were borrowing 10% of GDP in a single year, and that is completely unsustainable. And if you carry on doing that, you end up like Venezuela, bankrupt, and you depress living standards, and you have a crisis. And Argentina is doing something similar at the moment, and you've just seen a 30% devaluation of the Argentinian currency because they're not thought to be in proper control of their accounts, with the wish now to change their economic policy in the direction of too much borrowing. So I entirely accepted that you had to do something about the borrowing crisis then, but I never accepted that we needed a particularly draconian view of debt as a percentage of GDP. And again, I think there are two misunderstandings about this. I mean, the first is that people say that our current level, 87% or whatever it is, is too high. But we have bought in a quarter of that debt, $435 billion of it, is now owned by taxpayers through the Bank of England. And so I take that off the figure. I don't think that is not a real debt.
So it's 5% in reality that I think we're paying 3% back to ourselves of the debt or of the...
Well, $435 billion of the debt we own.
Yes.
And so we go through this absurd ritual that the Treasury, on behalf of taxpayers, pays the interest on the debt to the Bank of England as if it were proper debt.
Mm.
And the bank then gives them the money back as a dividend. And so it proves my point that it isn't an actual debt of the British taxpayer because the interest paid is washed by the interest received. And so it's a really a nonsense transaction. And so I look at the adjusted figure, which is about whatever it is, 64-65%, and I think that's a perfectly acceptable level of debt to GDP, and so I'm not one who says we've got to work a way to get that down anytime soon. My second reason for saying that is that there's an excess of saving and a shortage of spending in advanced economies around the world at the moment, and so interest rates are vanishingly low. The United Kingdom government can borrow at around 1%. And so having some debt is no great problem for taxpayers. It's actually a bit of a bargain. We are borrowing less than we are investing at the moment as a state. And we surely can invest to get a return superior to 1%. So there shouldn't really be any problem in doing a bit of borrowing.
So, I mean, building upon your answer there, in 2008, when Barack Obama came to power, the United States launched the TARP, which is a stimulus program to the tune of £850 billion, and mooted by many as an alternative to Osborne-led austerity. Mm. Do you think that anything like that is feasible? It was feasible in the UK?
Well, we did a bit of it through quantitative easing, didn't we? I mean, that's effectively what it is. It allows you to borrow more money more cheaply. Because instead of the market having to buy that debt, you buy it yourself with created money. Mm. It's an indirect way of creating money to spend.
But could we have done more of that and less sort of public spending cuts, as opposed to sort of focusing more on the public spending as opposed to the cash injection side?
Well, you could have done. I think, again, you know, you need to look at what I think was a misdescribed austerity programme. Because the Treasury and Mr. Osborne implied that most of the work was being done by spending cuts. They said 80% was being done by spending cuts. This was difficult to square with the very good point you made at the beginning that actually spending was going up. It wasn't going up as quickly as it had previously, but it was still going up. What was actually happening was that the work was being done by tax increases. And so there were some express increases in tax rates, most notably the quite substantial increase in VAT rates. But there was also, as the economy recovered, a very big increase in tax revenue, so that in practice, the work of deficit reduction was done by taxpayers paying more tax. And I then, and even more now, was saying we're in danger of overdoing this. I think we're overtaxing, and that we need to leave more money in the hands of individuals who are working and have their own family needs. And I'm glad I've at last got a government that may respond to that, because I think we have been overtaxing, and you need to let people keep more of the money they earn to give them a better incentive and a better lifestyle.
Okay. So we've talked about tax cuts, tax rises. At the moment, interest rates are at 0.75%. They're low across the world, but there's an increasing sense of doom that another recession could be around the corner. We're in a position where many European countries, after whether austerity and the bailout in the Eurozone crisis, are not in a position to cut further. What then is going to be the appropriate economic response to the next recession that hits? What fiscal and monetary policy can be set to work in order to support an economy in turbulent times, if not austerity?
Well, I think there are plenty of policy responses, and I don't buy this fear that some of the central banks and economic pundits have that we've run out of options. We have the same economic toolkit now that we had available and gradually learnt to use in 2009-10. I don't think there's going to be a world recession anytime soon. If you look at the two major economies of the world, the United States economy, I think, is growing quite well. I think it will continue to grow at more than 2% per annum. It has good money growth. It has fairly low interest rates already, with pressure to reduce them further. And it has some very successful policies going in to stimulate growth, most notably in areas like industry and energy. The Chinese economy has slowed quite a lot. The official figures may flatter the actual performance of the Chinese economy. But I would think it's easily growing at more than 4%. They say it's growing at around 6.5%. They won't want to lower their official forecasts of growth as 6+, and they are beginning to take more monetary action to ensure that the Chinese economy continues to move ahead at a reasonable pace. The Eurozone economy, third biggest, is struggling to grow at all. But I don't think it will go into an overall recession for the zone as a whole. Italy was in recession for the second half of last year. It's now only flirting with recession. It may just manage to get ahead this year. Germany is surprisingly the candidate one's most worried about. It had a bad negative quarter last quarter, could have another negative quarter this quarter. Germany is a special case because it is very dependent on industry and exports in general, and in particular on the motor car industry. And there is a perfect storm in the motor car industry created by sudden big change of policy, wanting to stop people buying the diesel and petrol cars that Germany is very good at making, and that has hit the market very badly. But on the other hand, the French economy is showing modest growth, the Spanish economy is quite lively. So I think Eurozone will probably avoid recession. But what should you do in the Eurozone? And indeed, what should the UK do? Because it had a small negative quarter last quarter. Part of that was technical on the stock cycle, because you had a lot of stock building in quarter one against a Brexit, which didn't happen. So you would then have had some destocking to compensate in quarter two. With any luck, quarter three, we'll see a bit more Brexit stock building again. And the thing might wash out. But I'm not happy with the growth rate in the UK, and it doesn't need to slow anymore. It needs to speed up. So what are the policy options? Well, there's a fiscal policy option which we've been talking about, which I think the government is going to do. I think they can afford a bit of tax cut, and they can afford a bit of targeted public spending in important areas like health and education. I think the Bank of England could take more action. I think Governor Carney has been too negative on the whole thing, and has not been very supportive at a time when other central banks around the world are very worried about recession risks and have been taking action. The bank has got a whole range of things. I mean, it could signal its loosening by cutting its rate back from 0.75 to 0.5, which is where it was for a long time. It could introduce another special line of credit for clearing banks to lend on to the domestic economy, because they cancelled all those special measures about a year ago. I think that was probably a bit premature. They could undertake more open market operations to influence liquidity and credit, because we have eye-wateringly tight money growth in the UK at the moment, the slowest of any of the advanced countries around the world, too slow. Above all, they could cheer up a bit, because they don't exude confidence and belief in the prospects, and maybe they will once we got through October the 31st. Where you've got a bigger problem than the UK has, as you have in parts of the Eurozone, and I think they may need to restart quantitative easing, and that is an option they have open for them. I think the Eurozone ECB under Lagarde may go more negative on the interest rates, because we have precedents for that. And if you want to understand what the Eurozone is going to look like over the next few years, I think you study the economic history of Japan, because I think there are quite a lot of similarities. Low inflation, negative interest rates, slow growth, fairly rich society, reluctance to consume, reluctance to venture, reluctance to borrow. There's going to be quite a lot of that around the Eurozone.
Okay. I mean, so you sound fairly confident that a recession is not
There won't be a global recession. Very confident of that. There will be individual country recessions, like the Italian one we've had, maybe a German one, probably going to be a South Korean one, because you've got a very nasty Japan-South Korea trade war.
Bond deals have gone into negative, which in only one occasion hasn't predicted a recession in modern economic history.
Is it only once? I thought it would be more often than that. But this idea that you've got a backward-sloping yield curve and therefore there's going to be a recession, I don't see any reason why that has to be true. I think what the negative sloping yield curve is showing is that the markets are desperate for more interest rate cuts. And the bond market is almost absurd. I mean, you've got 17 trillion now of bonds providing a negative interest rate, which means effectively you pay them to lend to them. I mean, why would you do that? You know, I'd never dream of buying a negative interest rate bond. And the only possible reason for people buying them is they think there's a bigger fool out there who will pay an even sillier price for them at some point in the future. Because if you just buy them and hold them till the government repays, you lose money. So you might as well hold the cash.
Okay. Max or Peter, would either of you like to come in on that? Okay. So we're dispelling the idea there's a global recession on the corner quite confidently.
Yeah, I don't think there'll be a global recession.
Okay.
No.
Right.
But it's a slow growth, and there are things that can be done to promote faster growth. And the battle between Trump and the Fed is riveting. And today is a very big day in the Fed story, because Jerome Powell is going to have to give the keynote address to the Jackson Hole meeting of central bankers and finance ministers. And what is he going to say? And he's probably going to disappoint, because the Fed lacks self-confidence in how it forms interest rates and how it understands what the American economy is doing. They were very badly knocked by the market not believing them at the end of last year, and they were forced into a change of policy without a proper change of explanation. And they're still struggling to explain what is going on. And I think they have the same problem as the Bank of England. I think they misdescribe the economies they're trying to regulate, because they have a domestic national model. And they have this concept that there's something called national capacity, and that when you get too close to national capacity, it then becomes very inflationary, because you've used up all the available labour, so then people want higher wages, and you've used up all the available supplies and components, so then people want higher prices. But the world's not like that. It's a global market. And so what happens in both America and Britain when you run out of local people who want to work for you? You invite in migrants, or you get them to do the work online in another country at a fraction of the price that British people would charge. And what happens when we run out of bricks or electronic components in Britain? You just ring up an overseas supplier and they send you a boatload. So, you know, there hasn't been anything like the inflation that the British and the American models would have predicted, and they've got to dump the models and start again.
Okay.
So you would suggest there just needs to be, in general, more confidence from governments and from banks in like the robustness of the economies?
That would help, but it's got to be well-based.
Yeah.
And you would only have more confidence in the growth rate if some of these other actions had been taken, you know, and that's what the markets are saying to the Fed, amongst others, that they do want more action. And the problem that the Fed has got is the president, under the rules of the game, shouldn't be giving public lectures to the Fed about how to set interest rates. That is meant to be the Fed's job.
Yet he is.
But he is. But they can't ignore him, because the markets are actually saying that the president is right. And so they're in this very difficult position.
Mm. Okay. So moving on back to austerity. We're going to talk more about the policy of austerity and George Osborne rather than the bailout.
Sure.
So The Guardian is among these group of people who frequently say there's a massive human cost to the policy of austerity. I think they were putting into court the 130,000 deaths linked to austerity. Maybe that's a grossly exaggerated figure. So if we have a, there may well be a group of people who are left behind by austerity. Should the government be intervening to help them, or should the government instead be allowing them to work their way back up, as it were?
Well, shock horror, to some extent, I agree with The Guardian. I think avoidable austerity is thoroughly undesirable, mm-hmm. but the biggest piece of avoidable austerity was 2007 to 2010.
Right.
It was the crash. And I'm not jobbing backwards. The advice and the views I expressed between 2007 and 2010 were warning of the danger of a downturn and offering a different way through the banking crisis from the one that they adopted.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in a position to be able to say, well, I thought you were wrong at the time, and I still think you were wrong looking backwards.
Okay.
And I and others have won quite a big part of the argument. Everybody now agrees that it was irresponsible regulation and conduct of economic policy prior to 2007 that set up the crash. Not everybody yet agrees with me that even worse was the action they took to bring the banks down, that was avoidable, and they didn't have to take the banks down as quickly and as dramatically and as publicly as they did. They could have managed the banks through, in my view. But they have now all accepted that if it ever happened again, they would treat it in a very different way, and they would move much more quickly to recapitalise the banks, and they would also want banking shareholders and banking bondholders to take more of the hit, because I think it was quite wrong that taxpayers took quite a chunk of the hit when it came to RBS in particular. So yes, you want to avoid austerity, and the best way to do that is to get better at managing cycles so that you don't have such extreme cycles. And so far, touch wood, since 2010, the Western world has managed to create a very prolonged cycle, nothing violent, and we've just been saying that maybe it's going to carry on, contrary to the worries people have. And although there are features of that people don't like, because they're impatient and they would like faster growth in their income, I would put to you that it's better to have a sluggish stability than it is to have these violent cycles with the big hit to people's incomes and public services that you got at the end of the last decade.
So in sort of that and sort of what you've been saying for sort of the rest of this sort of podcast is that you've got quite a dim view of austerity. You'd rather the government went a different way, correct? But according to your voting records, this is according to theyworkforyou.com and publicwhip.org, you've pretty consistently voted to not, maybe not cut, but to definitely hold the increase in certain elements of public spending. So the one which people quite often cite is benefits and welfare. Mm. So in 2016, you voted to cut the housing benefits and voted in favour of reducing the work allowance for universal credit. All of these things which, it's aimed at obviously reducing the government's deficit, but it definitely has a real human impact. And one which I think probably had the, or I mean, I don't have extensive statistics to go off this, but what I think may have had a very significant impact is that you've consistently voted against raising benefits in line with prices. So it's quite a few times, especially in 2013, where you've voted to cap it at 1% when the RPI and CPI has been well above 1% sort of consistently for the last decade.
You're quite right, but all of those votes were, of course, votes where I was on the three-line whip from the Conservative Party to vote with them. I expressed reservations and disagreements with some parts of those strategy, but I did not press my disagreement to the point where I actually voted against the government. Why didn't I? Well, I was elected as a Conservative, and my electors expect me normally to support the government, certainly when the government is carrying out what it said in the manifesto. And so I limit the number of things where I do actually take my disagreement to the point where I vote against the government I meant to be supporting. And in some of those cases, it wasn't just about reducing public spending. In some of the cases, it was getting a fairer balance between people in low-income work and people not in work. And so, for example, a very popular set of benefit reductions were the benefit reductions we put through where we said that there had to be a limit on the total amount of benefit that people could receive related to average earnings. And the only criticism I had of that was we didn't set it low enough. It was a very interesting development. The one I had most reservations about, and I'm trying to get them to rethink it, was the change about the number of bedrooms people are allowed to have in subsidised housing, and I hope that will be revisited by the Welfare Secretary, because I think that was a more difficult one.
Okay. In 2011 party conference, I would imagine you were there, David Cameron.
I was.
Yes, good. David Cameron said, "I describe myself as a modern, compassionate Conservative," and then jumping a little bit, "compassionate because you mustn't leave people behind in our country." Do we feel that austerity has taken its toll on that slightly modern reputation of the Conservative Party back then, and the fallout from both, even misattributed austerity from the bailout in 2007-11 has now come to bear on the Conservative Party's reputation?
No, I don't think it has. I mean, a left-wing supporter of Mr. Corbyn would obviously make that claim, but I would disagree with such a person. Over the coalition years, income inequality actually reduced, and there were big moves to take more and more people out of income tax altogether, so that people on lower pay kept all of the money they earned rather than having to make a contribution through income tax. And there was a definite move to tackle some of the underlying causes of poverty, most notably getting people into work. And I think the great success of the coalition and succeeding Conservative governments has been just that, that we took over a country with this crisis going on, big hit to real incomes, a lot of people losing their jobs, squeeze on public services and spending, and that over the last 9 years now, there's been very good job growth, and there's now been some real income growth, not as fast as we would like, but a bit of real income growth.
Okay.
We're above the levels that Labour got to before the crash, and we need to do more work along those lines, because the best way out of poverty is a job. And the best way to a well-paid job is to start off in a not-so-well-paid job and get training and work your way up.
It is easier, though, to get a job in certain areas than others. So I think unemployment in the South East is around 3.2% and falling relatively quickly.
Yeah.
And then in the North East, it's 5% and a bit and sort of stagnating. So should there be a way that the government focuses on the less developed regions rather than... Because generally, there's always been a complaint that there's always been too much spending on London and the South East. So should that be changed?
There has to be spending on both, and you do need to reinforce success. I mean, why is there so much transport spending in the London area? Well, it's because there are so many travellers, simply short of capacity, and the trains are over full. That's true of some of the commuter routes into some of the northern cities, and that must also be addressed as it is being done. Again, you see, I think people try and make a sort of party political war out of all this, but in my experience, Labour governments, Labour-Liberal governments, Conservative-Liberal governments, they all want the same high-level aim. They would agree with your statement of the aim. Do we want these degrees of variation around the country? No. Would we like the North to be as rich as the South East? Of course we would. And we're not standing in their way. And all governments have had that as an aim. We've all intervened in different ways and similar ways to bring that about. It's never actually occurred, but there have been some successes. Some places have come up a bit more than others, and it's often quite local, and you do need to work in conjunction with local mayors and local councils, because a lot of it is about promotion of a location as being a good location for a particular type of activity or for inward investment from the rest of the country or from outside. And so government has to try and harness it with local government, and that was the whole idea of the George Osborne Northern Powerhouse proposal. In part, it was a way of routing more public money into the North, but in part, it was a big PR expression that, you know, come on, you're thinking of coming to Britain, why don't you go to the North? It's really exciting, good people.
Do you think it's had the desired impact?
Like it's had some impact, yes.
Okay.
And I think the sensible mayors and senior figures in the Labour Party have gone along with it because they see that it is a genuine attempt to represent the North as a very exciting place. And when I go to Manchester now or Leeds, you know, it's really much more exciting because there are loads of cranes there. There's a lot going on. There's new flats being built. There's new commercial premises being built. There have been some really exciting new retail centres. I mean, not in the North, but in the Midlands. If you go to the rebuilt Birmingham station. It's fabulous. It's this great retail estate, and then that attracts people in the evenings, and it creates life and generates money. Because, you know, in the bad days of the recession and so forth 10 years ago, if you went to some of those northern cities, there just weren't enough people around, and certainly not enough people around with spending power. And you only have a great city if you've got people spending in the bars and the clubs and the restaurants and the shops and being there in the evenings as well as during the day. And you can see that happening now rather more, and that's the process by which we can create great centres in places like Manchester and in the north and Birmingham in the Midlands, alongside London, which is this colossal UK success, truly global city, phenomenal place by world standards, very well off. And you do need to reinforce that success as well.
Okay. And on our final question, then we'll let you go. More going back to a more global perspective, it's broadly considered that politics is becoming in places more extreme, more radical and uncompromising. Do you think this is in any way linked to austerity, or whether in the Eurozone, whether during the recession, or whether implemented in the early 2010s?
Yes, I think it is. I think it is quite often related to austerity, very much so in the Eurozone, and to some extent the Trump phenomenon in the United States of America as well. Okay. I don't regard Trump as extreme, but populist is what I would call it, rather extreme. And I've recently written a book on these populist movements called We Don't Believe You, and the book takes about 10 subjects and explains how there's a huge gap between where the liberal elite who believe in international treaties and international rules order are in their thinking and where the public are in their thinking. And the analysis works for Italy with the Lega and Cinque Stelle movements. It works for the Trump movement in the United States of America. It works for the Brexit movement in the United Kingdom. There are common features as to why people don't accept everything they've been told by establishments. And one of the underlying problems is that living standards retreated too much in the crash of 07 to 10 and haven't picked up enough. One of the features is that there are quite a number of casualties of rapid technical change, and they don't feel that governments have been sensitive enough to that. But it's not just that. I mean, there was a general revulsion to the Middle Eastern wars, which Trump understood and put into his campaign, which the Clinton didn't seem to understand, and quite a lot of European governments didn't understand. And then there's the whole issue of political correctness, and too many people feel there are a whole series of subjects they're not allowed to talk about anymore. And whilst the last thing I want to do is to encourage the wrong kind of talking, you do need to find a language that people can use to express their concerns.
Okay. Any final comments?
I just wanted to bring up, sort of before we finish, I'm quite conscious of time, that
make this the last one. Yeah.
That at the start you said how that you believe that austerity, you know, if this government does what it says it's going to do, that austerity will have ended and we will progress past this point.
Mm.
But aren't there deeper underlying social issues caused by the last 8-10 years of austerity, which will take a lot longer, such as the two things I've got here are policing and homelessness. So as of November of last year, there are 320,000 homeless people in Britain, and that has been increasing at an alarmingly high rate ever since. Obviously the recession would have had a significant toll, but ever since then it's continued to increase. So that is an issue which will continue and won't just go as soon as we declare that austerity has ended. And then on policing, under the Conservative government for the last 8 years, there has been a reduction. Every year there's been a reduction in the number of policemen, and so funding has essentially also been decreasing. So especially funding for youth offending teams, which were generally, they were considered to be quite successful. So in 2010-2011, they received 145 million. But last year that halved to 72 million. So that is going to have and has had a significant long-term impact, such as in, you know, the increase in knife crime in London and stuff like that.
So yeah, the government agrees with you, which is why the Prime Minister announced 20,000 more policemen immediately to be recruited, and I'm sure more will follow that, but you can only accept a certain pace of recruitment and training, because you've got to find the people willing to do it and then get them up to speed. But I think, yes, we do have too small a police force for the demands placed upon it. On the wider issue, again, I think there's less disagreement between the parties than the party debate sometimes requires there to be. Am I as offended as Labour is that some people sleep rough or don't have a decent home? Yes, of course I am. And we all want to find a solution to that kind of issue. The Blair government saw that there was a growing problem of rough sleeping, and they moved very quickly and they put in various measures. The May government saw that was happening again and copied some of the Blair measures and was very keen to try and make progress. And various policies are being put in to make sure that there is always somewhere that people can sleep other than on the streets. Doesn't always happen, because you discover that it's more complicated than that. It's not just shortage of places. Indeed, there are places available for people. It's whether they like the idea of doing it. And you discover then there are a whole series of problems in their lives, usually related to drugs. And so then you get into the area of work that Ian Duncan Smith has dedicated a lot of his last decade to, which is how can we, on a cross-party or no-party basis, come up with a series of measures that reduce the number of vulnerable people who lead lives that the rest of us think look dreadful and probably don't suit them either, because it's very dysfunctional. And that is about persuading people that they have a drug problem or they have a training and work problem, whatever it is. So go back to my original point, the best way to get out of poverty is to have a job. And most of us think you have a better lifestyle if you have the work discipline for some of your time, and then you have your leisure time with some money as a result of your work effort to provide that balance. If you don't have that basis for income and you don't have that stability and discipline in your life for some part of your life, it is much more difficult to know how people can conduct themselves and what you should then do by way of assistance. Because they just want you to give them money. But if they've still got a drug problem, that isn't necessarily going to resolve the issue. You've got to work with them, and at a certain point they've got to be persuaded that they need help. And then the state has got plenty of help. And what Ian found when he started studying this was that there are a limited number of problem families, problem individuals in the country. And we spend a huge amount of money on them. But a lot of the spending is the kind of spending you don't want to spend on them, because it's probation and court time and police time and so forth. When what you want to do is to target that spending in a way which works with them, to give them the kind of life chances that you and I have got. But it's in their mind. A lot of it is mental health. And that's why the government's put a lot more emphasis on mental health.
Okay, an important topic. Okay. Thank you very much for your time, Mr. Redmond.
There you go. Well, thank you for doing a lot of background work and serious questions. I wish some of the journalists would learn this technique.
Thank you very much for taking this time out to talk to us, Mr. Redwood. Appreciate it. Thank you very much. If you want to get in touch with us about this episode, you can find us on our Instagram, which is at podcastpoorly, or our Twitter of the same handle. Our Instagram is definitely the one to watch. Alternatively, if you want to send us comments in longer form or any business inquiries, the place to do that is poorlyinformeddiscussion@gmail.com. Thank you very much for listening, guys. We'll be back with you next week. And of course, thank you, Mr. Redwood, again for joining us. Hope you enjoyed. But goodbye.